In the darkness beneath a ruined castle, in a long-forgotten family crypt so worn by countless rains that its once ornate stone-carved crest has become an unrecognizable blur, there lies an unremarkable stone sarcophagus, inside of which is an ancient wooden casket, and after long ages, its rough-hewn lid slowly opens, and a bony hand, its fingers corrupted by the molder of the grave, reaches out and grasps around until it finds what it seeks. A podcasting microphone. Hey, we're back.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith. In this episode, Dr. Karen Stolzno and I interview Dr. Darren Naish about his new book, Hunting Monsters. We plan to return to our regular episode schedule, or as regular as Monster Talk ever manages, in April of this year. But when I heard that Darren Naish's new book was out, I couldn't wait another month to share it with you guys. I know a lot of you are like me and really love books, maybe even a bit too much, if such a thing is possible. So we're just going to get right into this episode and talk about this new book. A link to the book and to Darren's great blog and podcast will be in our show notes at monstertalk.org. After the interview, I'll catch you up on what's coming up next from
Monster Talk.
Today we're talking with Darren Naish, who's the author of the Tetrapod Zoology blog, which is currently hosted by Scientific American. He's the co-host of the Tet Zoo podcast, which you should all be listening to, and he's an author or contributor to many books, and today we're discussing his latest book, which is his first in well over a month, Hunting Monsters, Cryptozoology and the Reality Behind the Myths. Welcome back to Monster Talk, Dr. Darren Naish.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Hi, Darren.
Hi.
So let's get started with Cash for Questions.
That's an in-joke.
It is! So, but speaking of cash, I think our listeners will be delighted at the price of your newest book, but it's only available on the Kindle right now. So how many copies do you need to sell in order to get corporeal versions released?
Good question. I don't know the answer. I don't know if the company, the publishers know the answer either. The woolly answer is if it does well enough as an ebook, then it will be released as a dead tree book. So we shall see.
Are you going to offer it in other formats too, like Nook and iBooks?
So far as I understand, yes. I mean, it's only been out at the time of speaking for about a week. And so far, it's only available on Amazon. It will be available through other digital retailers. And remember, you don't have to have a Kindle to read an ebook. I mean, you can download a Kindle app for any device, which I didn't know until I did that. So I've been reading on my phone and my PC. So, yeah, let's see.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks.
And it's only $6.99 in the US, and I don't know how to convert that to metric, but it's a very reasonable price.
Yeah, it's like £2.50 or something, which is as much as a large bag of, I was going to say crisps, but I realize you call them potato chips or something.
Yeah.
Chips,
yeah. Well, we understand crisps here.
Yeah.
Well, especially Australians do.
Yeah, so, yes, the two of you understand that you're saying the wrong word. I get it. Okay.
The language is called English.
So we want to get started with the meaty question. Why is it imperative that monster lovers make your book part of their digital library immediately?
That's an excellent question. Thank you for asking. Well, it's dead cheap. So what do you got to lose, first of all? Secondly, I see it as part of one of several books that are part of this pro-science, skeptic-led movement in cryptozoology, which we all know of these books. There's an enormous number of them that are on the credulous side of cryptozoological investigation, prepare. I don't really offer, you know, that much deconstruction of the phenomena and the processes behind them.
Intellectually shoddy.
Yes, yes.
Well, they tell the stories in the folklore, don't they? And
yes,
and that's about it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and there's so much stuff to discuss. Like there's a whole list of things that I wanted to talk about, and I've been looking for an avenue for a long time. You know, an excuse to cover these subjects. For example, as someone who's very interested, obviously, you know, evolution, speculative evolution, the creatures that people come up with in fiction. Cryptozoology, I see as very much a part of that. It's kind of like an excuse for people to invent creatures. And I think this is like a fundamental human thing, a thing that people have been doing for as long as we've been around. We kind of invent creatures and they become part of our psyche, part of, you know, folklore, part of culture. And a thing I discuss quite a lot in the book is the concept of cryptozoology as culture. And to that end, you know, I think that like, I'm not a trained folklorist or a, you know, historian, but you can marry these ideas about cryptozoology as culture with an evolutionary perspective, because many of the creatures that are now in the cryptozoological literature have got almost a life of their own, because people have invented a creature, and as they've tried to rationalize it within the scientific paradigm, people have constructed these complex historical narratives, what kind of creature it is, how it's evolved, its background, and even its ecology, its behavior. A lot of the cryptozoological literature, and literature in the broader sense, as in, you know, articles online as well as published stuff, there are a whole bunch of cryptozoologists who talk at length about cryptids as real flesh and blood animals with a biological background, but there hasn't been much, if any, skeptical evaluation of that, any kind of reasoned discussion of that, and I think that's needed. And that's something fairly novel in this book. Hasn't really been explored that much before.
But, you know, I think our listeners are probably they're going to be more exposed to skeptical books about cryptozoology than your average monster fan. But
yeah.
What makes your book different from the other skeptical books that are out there?
Well,
I have good answers for this, but I just,
you know, not again.
I might need you to help me with this one because.
Starting with the price. No, sorry. I don't want to answer the question I just asked you, but I would say that having read your book, most of it, I did have to skim a bit just to make it for the interview.
Sure.
Here, but you bring up some really interesting ideas that I have not seen in other places about plausible explanations for some of these monsters, not just wish fulfillment sort of explanations. And you go into a great deal of detail that normally one would have to look deep into a cryptozoology sort of bulletin board to get this level of nuance. I think, do a very good job of bringing a scientific bearing and your own paleontological training to bear on these topics. So that's my take on it. And $6.99. So
that too. And I think towards the end of the book, where you're talking about some of the psychological aspects of belief in cryptozoology, I think that a lot of skeptical books don't treat those aspects.
And
don't
forget your own illustrations.
Thank you, a few of my own little pictures in there, for many of which were done for other projects, but recycled here. Yes, I mean, I've got a combination of a list of things. I mean, I think, as you say, this kind of detailed attempts to rationalize cryptids as zoological, as real animals, hasn't really been done much before. Obviously, I've got some new interpretations, or at least some new syntheses of recently proposed explanations for the identities behind. You know, I quite like it when you have these pieces of evidence, lake monster photographs, photographs of sea monster carcasses, and we can actually, you know, use a grounded scientific perspective to try and evaluate those. That's obviously something I've written quite a lot about on tetrapod zoology. I have various articles online about interpreting eyewitness evidence, photographic bits of evidence and carcass stories and so on. I've got a lot of that stuff in there. Some of that will be novel. And while I have, I mean, a plus point of this book is I have covered a diversity of cryptids. I mean, you got your classics in there like lake monsters, sea monsters, crypto hominids, anomalous primates, whatever you want to call them, Australian cryptids like the Queensland tiger and the bunyip and so on. It's quite common for books to cover that kind of diversity. I'm thinking of Loxton and Prothero's Abominable Science, for example. They did this chapter by chapter treatment, didn't they? But I think the level of analysis that you have here, these new interpretations of cases, that's novel to an audience.
Well, I think the more skeptical books, the better about this topic.
Yeah. I was listing them the other day. There's not really that many. I mean, I'd count on two hands maybe the good skeptical analyses.
Yeah. So there are a lot of mythical or creatures that we label as being mythical, like unicorns and mermaids. Would we still consider those to be cryptids? Because when I think of cryptids, I tend to think of ones that like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, and maybe there's some kind of hierarchy there that some might be more plausible than others. But with a lot of these legendary creatures, do we still call those cryptids or not?
Well, yeah, technically we don't, do we? Because technically a cryptid is an animal for which there is eyewitness or evidence of some kind, eyewitness evidence, testimonial evidence, which pertains to an animal as yet unrecognized by science. But I think it is kind of a fuzzy distinction. Where do you draw the line? I mean, if you look at a lot of the classic cryptids, people are prepared to go back to accounts that are like beyond the limits of living people. They're talking about legends and recollections of, you know, in the time of our father's father, those kinds of anecdotes. This is the case for sea monsters from medieval Europe and mystery hominids, you know, man-shaped creatures from, you know, North America or remote Asia. And if you're going to do that, then there's a whole list of mystery creatures or alleged mystery creatures that we do discount. I mean, nobody today would discuss cryptozoology and talk about the possible existence of lake monsters and sea monsters and Bigfoot and Yeti, and in the same breath talk about dragons. But that's because we have made an arbitrary decision at some point that we're going to exclude the creatures called dragons because we're pretty confident that they're not based on real animals. But I can't explain this particularly well, but my vague feeling there is that we have made an arbitrary decision that we are going to exclude some mystery animals because we do now find them ridiculous. But that's a product of our own time. Michelle Merger and other researchers have argued that imagine that you were alive in the late 1800s or the mid 1800s, you could still be thinking of animals like unicorns and dragons as potentially real animals that might still await discovery in remote places. We know that people did think this was, you know, plausible. They did think there were dragon-like creatures that hadn't yet been discovered. I don't just mean animals like big monitor lizards. I mean giant winged reptiles that lived in the mountains and carried off farm girls and such. there is a real reason for, you know, there's strong reasons for thinking that people did regard them as biologically plausible animals. So you raise a very interesting point. Yeah, I do think there's a degree of fuzziness, arbitrariness, if that's a word.
Maybe this is a silly question, but is there anyone who is researching unicorns and mermaids from a scientific perspective that you're aware of?
I am aware of people who are looking at not unicorns, but I can tell you that there are flesh and blood cryptozoologists who within recent years have written about creatures that they call merpeople or mermen. There are cryptozoologists who have honestly proposed that sightings of fish-tailed semi-humans or amphibious or aquatic semi-humans are actually based on real observations of real undiscovered animals.
Have they done an aerial survey?
it's a little bit. I'm not really sure whether I should mention names, but there's a notorious book written on mystery primates of the world, written by two well-known cryptozoologists, and it proposes that the chupacabra and the lizard man and a bunch of other weird alleged humanoid creatures are actually descriptions of some kind of mer beings. They call them mer beings. That's it. So
you know, sounds very PC. Mer beings. Yeah. Mer people.
I think with some of these cryptids, the ones that seem to take their origin back to movies, we should start calling them scripteds.
Nice.
I just thought of that after all these years. Oh my god. Okay.
The transition from movie to
because it seems to be a recurring theme. I think they covered that in the Loxton Prothero book as well, the impact potentially of the King Kong film on Nessie, for example. But let's talk about your book, which is only $6.99 on Amazon, and a link to that will be in the show notes.
Or £2.99.
Or £2.99, or kilos, or whatever. You do cover a lot of the classics in this book, like monsters that if you buy a book on monsters, you're going to see these creatures. And I'd like to talk about a few of those without spoiling the whole book. But let's go with the sighting of a sea monster from the Daedalus.
The famous 1848 Daedalus encounter, one of the most influential sea monster reports of all time. What do you want to say about it?
What I want to do is like, whet the appetite of the listener who might be interested in buying this book, but who thinks, am I going to learn anything new? Or can I just listen to Monster Talk? I would promise them they're going to learn something new. You've got a lot of great material in there. But I thought maybe you could talk about what some of these animals, we'll just go through a few of them, what you think they might be.
Yeah, let's say a little bit more about the Daedalus encounter, because I think it, together with the Valhalla sighting of 1902 off the coast of Brazil, the Daedalus encounter is a truly pivotal sea monster account. It seemed to have a massive impact in terms of the sorts of creatures that people described. You've got to remember that between about the 1820s and the 1850s, this is the time when people are first learning about plesiosaurs in particular, which are having a huge impact on how people perceive life of the past. And the Daedalus creature, observed off the coast of Natal, off the Atlantic coast of Africa, it's described as possibly being some giant long-bodied reptile-like creature with a big blunt head. And you have this pivotal exchange happening in newspapers and journals at the time between people like, most famously, Richard Owen, a famous Victorian naturalist, biologist, paleontologist. And he's saying that, this can't be an undiscovered animal. It's got to be, they must have seen an elephant seal, a big seal that has been carried too far north on an iceberg or something. And you had other people, including the famous Captain Mackay, primary witness, saying that no, there's no doubt we saw this at close enough range for it to be, it was an undiscovered beast, and we could see it with so much clarity. He famously said that if it was a person of his acquaintance, he would have known them, he would have been able to recognize their face. And really important point, there are these two famous, I think they're woodcuts, these two famous illustrations that appeared in the Illustrated London News at the time. And whenever we think of this sighting now, we imagine those particular illustrations. But very poorly known until recently is the fact that there's a first-hand illustration. The famous illustrations that I've just mentioned were drawn by professional artists for a newspaper. They weren't done first-hand by Mackay, by a witness, but another witness, Lieutenant Edgar Drummond, did illustrate the creature from, I don't know if he did it at the time, but it was certainly, a first generation, an illustration done by a witness rather than a retelling from a witness. And it depicts something completely different. The creature that Drummond drew looks really different from this classic illustration. It's far less impressive, and it's different in some key details. It shows a far lower creature with a kind of more pointed tip to the snout. And rather than being this massive, hulking kind of rectangular shape, it's a long and low kind of pointy thing with a, I think it's got a small portion coming out of the water, and then a gap, and then a long and low pointed anterior section. And there's an interesting point there because, you know, we've all been relying on an illustration that does not depict a first-hand observation. And as to what it is, I mean, I've always been of the opinion that we can't really know what it is. I've been prepared at times to consider it a, you know, misidentification of, you know, a huge piece of floating wood or something. But while I was writing the book, this article by Gary Galbraith was published, and I guess we won't discuss that because that'll give everything away. It's already people that know this stuff will already know it. I mean, it's already been discussed online quite a lot. But Galbraith did propose an identification, which, you know, I can completely agree with, and that's the one I have gone with in the book. It can be identified as a known animal, and this does fit precisely with Drummond's eyewitness sketch. It doesn't fit with the famous Illustrated London News sketch supervised by Mackay, but it does fit completely with Drummond's sketch.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we'll never know for sure, but I looked at that suggestion, and then I went and looked at photos of the animal that they suggest, and wow, it's a pretty compelling argument if there's accuracy there, right? So,
yeah, it's kind of embarrassing that we'd all miss that beforehand.
Yeah.
But well, these things happen.
How soon was the sketch made after the sighting?
I think it was within a very short time.
Okay.
I can't remember if that's known. Yeah, no, I can't remember. There's one unusual thing about Drummond's illustration is that I think it shows... The famous Illustrated London News pictures show the ship in the background as if the witness was sat at sea looking at the monster with the ship behind it. And Drummond does a similar thing, almost as if that's a kind of people can't help themselves, but reminding people. Maybe they did that to show that was the scale of the creature to the ship.
But not that the creature necessarily had scales, right?
Oh, he's on fire today.
Well, it's been a long break, right?
So. Yeah, you all built up, hey?
What about Hugh Gray's photo of Nessie?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I really love the Loch Ness Monster photographs. I mean, not sure how many good ones there are. Good in quotes there. There's kind of like 15 to 20 famous Loch Ness Monster photographs. The ones you see in, you know, virtually every single book. And if for every single one of them, you look into it, you can... there's a list that are ambiguous, and we're never going to know what they are. But there's a number where people have looked into them in some detail, and we can now say what they were. We know enough about the circumstances behind the people taking the photographs, exactly where they were when they took the photographs. I spoke a lot with Dick Rayner, well-known Loch Ness investigator, while preparing the Lake Monster chapter of this book. And the Hugh Gray photograph, is it, I think from 1933, is, you know, one of the earliest alleged Nessie photographs. It shows this weird sinuous lump with kind of a vaguely S-shaped pointy end and a big bulky end. It's quite high out of the water. It casts a large shadow on the water. You get the impression from the size of the ripples, and we have a general good intuitive feel for how big things are based on the appearance of the surface of the water. We do kind of have a natural feel for how big things are. This thing isn't gigantic, but it's not particularly small. It's middling. It's kind of like half the size of a person, that kind of a size, I think. This weird shape, and it's blurry, and it appears to be double exposed. The object is partly duplicated in the frame. And look at the different Loch Ness Monster books. Now, every single Loch Ness Monster book, not every single one, most Loch Ness Monster books are written with an agenda. The author has decided that there's a specific identification for the animal, which they prefer, and they are then picking and choosing from the eyewitness accounts of photographs, saying, oh, this matches that, you know, oh, this is clearly consistent with a long-necked seal, or this is clearly consistent with a giant amphibian, or this is consistent with Tully Monstrum, a 30-centimeter-long carboniferous worm-like organism from Illinois, as is famously the case in one particular book. So the grey photograph, you have it in some books, they say, ah, oh, look, you can see it's got this wormy necky bit, and it's got these weird lumps on the side that are consistent with the side organs on this worm. So that's the author, so Halliday, the author saying it, so it's a giant Tully Monstrum worm thing. Then you've got other authors saying, oh, look, it looks like a plesiosaur with a long neck, and you can see the bases of flippers there. And there's also a quite popular suggestion, I'm sure you will have heard of this, some people have said that it looks like the head of a dog coming towards you with a stick in its mouth.
Once
you know this, once you know what to look for, you can see that. Or I can see it. I know some people that can't see it, but I'm convinced that is pareidolia, that is people recognizing a shape.
Yeah. Some priming, I guess, when you're told what it is and what it looks like.
Oh, this, yes. This photo in particular is definitely one of the Rorschach tests for Nessie fans. I mean, for sure.
Yeah. But it doesn't. The swimming dog thing doesn't work because you've only got half the face there. You don't have any trace of the body. And I mean, I almost feel that you don't need to debunk it or discuss it, but you kind of do because there are some people that take it seriously. And also, it's not consistent with the size of the ripples. Now, in discussing this with Dick Rayner, he pointed out that this object, we can tell, it's an old black and white photograph, and as I say, it's blurry and double exposed, but it shows a large, very pale, almost white object on the surface of the lock with a long neck. Well, even if you're not looking at the photograph, think about this. What big white long neck things can you think of that sit quite high on the surface of the water? I'm absolutely convinced now that it is a swan. Hugh Gray photographed as a swan, and with its head submerged in a pose that is not completely typical but is sometimes adopted by swans. I can show photographs that show swans in the same pose, and this explains all the details you can see in the image. The little side knobs that some people have suggested are the limbs or side organs of assorted animals are a perfect match for the ankle joint of a bird on the water. The pointed end that's opposite the end with the long structure, the pointed end is absolutely consistent in shape with a swan's tail. You can see this junction between the wing feathers and the body feathers, which of course you see in birds when they have their wings folded up. And so I traced over the photograph for the book and tried to draw like exactly what I meant, and did a really, really bad job. They got the publishers got a professional artist to do it, and so we have this nice illustration of what I think it is. And
so they come into the area then?
Swans are all over the place in the British Isles. Can't move for swans, and they are quite frequently on the surface of Loch Ness. So I'm really quite pleased with that as an explanation. And
I thought the illustration does a very good job of matching that pose and makes it very, very, very plausible. I mean, obviously because it's a blurry photo, we'll never know for sure. But it looks like a really nice match.
I think
they're
so.
Always blurry.
Yeah. It has to be a monster photograph.
Yeah.
Although that's not wholly true. I mean, there are a couple of crisp photographs, which the Tony Shields Muppet photograph is a nice one, and the O'Connor loaf of bread or inflated plastic bag photograph, that's quite clear as well. But it should also be said, this again isn't well known unless you've looked into this, but Hugh Gray, as is often the case with the people who record these kinds of evidence in quotes, people that record photographs or whatever, they generally aren't just people who are just out, you know, on a vacation and accident and encounter a monster by surprise. They do tend to be people with a bit of a with some background interests in the subjects. And Hugh Gray had what's been called I think the word obsession or something has been mentioned in connection with it. He said he took he claimed several sightings prior to this photograph, which of course is not impossible, but it does raise questions. And he also said that this was one of five photographs, I think, taken at the time, and none of the others have ever been released, which this is circumstantial evidence, of course.
Sure.
But yeah, it casts it in a slightly different light.
Sounding like the Patterson-Gimlin.
We're talking
about people who are looking, actively looking for these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the greatest coincidence of all. I mean, you've got two people who were planning to make a docudrama sort of film about hunting for Bigfoot, had written a book about it, included photos, and then actually, coincidentally, got the only motion picture of an alleged Bigfoot.
What are the odds? Yeah, and
looks
and
just
not
like
only
their
that.
Picture, right?
Yes, in one of in Patterson's book, he includes this illustration, which is a depiction of William Rose encounter from the 1950s, which is this has been said by Loxton and Prothero and various other investigators by now, but the illustration included in Patterson's book is almost the perfect storyboarded prototype of what they filmed at Bluff Creek. I think it's a mirror image. I think it's depicted with the animal walking from right to left instead of left to right, but otherwise the look of the creature and so on. It's quite clear that William Rose's alleged encounter of, I think, 1955 was heavily inspirational to Patterson's view of what Sasquatch Bigfoot was like.
Yeah, so I think the other thing that I found really interesting was when you talked about the Kraken, because you went into a lot of detail about it's not being what people think of when they think of the Kraken.
Yeah, this has been a bugbear of mine for a while. And again, not original to me. This mostly comes from my discussions with Charles Paxton, who's published at least one article on this subject. But you frequently hear, whenever the Kraken is mentioned, you hear people, not just people sympathetic to cryptozoology, you hear this among people widely, did you know the Kraken is based on the giant squid? So people knew the giant squid prior to its official description, and they called it the Kraken. The Kraken is the giant squid. No, this is categorically not correct. The Kraken prior to the 1800s is regarded as something quite different. It's this weird horned or antenna-bearing island monster thing, which doesn't definitely have any characteristics typical of cephalopods, of squids or octopuses, nor does it have any special features that would link it to Arctuthis, the giant squid. And it may be that several different things were combined in creating the mythology, the lore of the Kraken. Some people have suggested that it may have been it may involve encounters with large turtles or whales. There may be emergent volcanoes coming out of the sea, or floating pumice islands. Undersea volcanoes sometimes produce these eruptions of pumice, which float on the water, look like a solid island, but it's literally just floating gas-filled rock on the surface of the sea. And also there's this legend of a giant crab, which is from the Scandinavian coast, which is kind of incorporated into the Kraken legend as well. So it's all a bit messy. It's several different stories. Predominantly it's this island monster creature, which is sometimes said to be polyp-like or starfish-like, or to have horns or antennae that look like trees when it's sitting at the surface. There's these stories about, you know, sailors landing on one of these islands and then they start a fire, they go catch some game and cut down a tree, and then it turns out that it's a sleeping monster and it sinks and they all die with the sinking island.
Somebody must have survived to tell the tale, but
always
everybody died.
So why did the perceptual idea of this creature change so much over time?
Good logical question. Pierre Denis de Montfort in the early 1800s wrote these fabulously speculative, fantastic tales about giant octopuses and giant squids, which now were both known scientifically, and said that they were, you know, terrible terrific, frightening, powerful beasts that could, you know, grab big ships by the masts and pull them underwater. And to justify his belief in these giant cephalopods, he said that the Kraken of legend was the same thing. And he selected the bits of those stories that sound somewhat squid or octopus-like and ignored all the rest of the stuff. So wow. When mainstream modern cryptozoologists, of course, most famously Bernard Heuvelmans, when they wrote about the Kraken legends again and spoke about anecdotes involving giant squids and giant octopuses in the 1950s onwards, they were adopting Denis de Montfort's version of the Kraken. They weren't going back to the original pre-1800s stuff. So,
This happened with the Chupacabra. I mean, it's turned from, you know, a humanoid with spines into basically mangy dogs. And for those of us who liked the spiny version, this is ridiculous. But that seems to be the cultural shift.
Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. I don't talk about Chupacabras in the book, obviously, but I don't really regard it as... I don't know, is it the thing? Oh, well, I was just about to say it's not really part of cryptozoology, but actually now it is, because there are researchers who are of the opinion that these weird so-called blue dogs are some undiscovered canid. Undiscovered, I mean, even though they've got dead ones and their DNA has been analysed and such. Yeah. But yeah, how that made the leap from your spiny, possible grey alien type beast to blue dogs, very strange.
Yes, indeed. There's a lot about the claims.
It does. Mm-hmm. Mm. Speaking of the Kraken, do you have any thoughts on, there's a couple of things that always come up when I think about the Kraken, and that is a long time ago I saw the Arthur C. Clarke Mysterious World. Well, he did like several series, there was one on sea monsters, and they talked about and actually interviewed Lieutenant Cox, a British sailor who had actually allegedly been attacked by a giant squid and had sucker marks to prove it. And there was also a famous attack on the USS Stein by some sort of creature that they think might have been a giant squid. Any thoughts on those, or is that something you've looked in at all?
Yeah, I admit it's not something I have looked into that much, but what you'll notice is that these descriptions pertain to generic large squid. And in all the discussions of, you know, what's the identity behind the Kraken, and this is the mystery of the giant squid, when people are thinking specifically about Architeuthis, this specific kind of unusual deep water squid that we call the giant squid, whereas when lay people are talking about, you know, this guy who was attacked by a squid, and when squids have been seen to attack vessels, they aren't definitely Architeuthis. There are a whole load of large squid, and even a squid that's 2 meters long in total length, including the main tentacles, not the super long feeding tentacles, but the regular arms. Yeah, a 2 meter squid is a frightening, enormous beast if you're in water with it, especially if it's attacking you. So,
and it's almost $14.
I'm often skeptical of the idea that these actually do pertain to specifically Architeuthis. And what we know of Architeuthis at the moment, it's not really shaping up to be the kind of, you know, rampant ship attacking, human eating, horrible, powerful monster thing. It seems more of a kind of fairly lazy, slow moving, sessile thing that uses its long arms, the two long feeding tentacles to grab other squid and small prey.
What I think I hear you saying is that you endorse the Harryhausen version over the 20,000 Leagues version.
They're both good. I kind of prefer the 20,000 Leagues version. That scene is epic. But what does the Harryhausen one do? I can't remember.
Oh, well, they released the Kraken. This is from Clash of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans, of course.
Yeah. So yeah. No problem. Yeah. You can't remember everything all at once, right? So.
Well, I've just got a more general question about belief. And that is that, is there necessarily a connection between belief in land and sea creatures? So, for example, if someone believes in Bigfoot, is it inevitable that they'll believe in the Loch Ness Monster as well? Or might they poo-poo the idea of Loch Ness Monster?
No, that's a very good question. And I don't think that's one of those questions that someone really should have investigated, and I don't think they have. I mean, what you'll notice is that people that do have a fairly strong bias towards the reality of the cryptozoological superstars, they tend to be consistent across the board, in my experience. So people that do think that Yetis and Bigfoots and such are real do tend to be quite sympathetic towards the existence of lake monsters and sea monsters, and vice versa. And we know this was the case among obviously much of the book discusses the research of Hoovermans and Ivan Sanderson, and I specifically say in the book, it's often hard to pin Hoovermans down specifically on what he actually thought, because, to be frank, his writing was often so obtuse. But the fact that he produced this, is it 1986? He published this list of the specific target animals of cryptozoology. He came up with like a list of, I can't remember, it's like 100. It's a surprising number. But he really came out in that article as not just endorsing the existence of beasts from, you know, the deepest Amazon and tropical Southeastern Asia, these things that, you know, even the most skeptical of us do think that there's a possibility they could exist. He did endorse existence of his 9 kinds of sea serpents and the Loch Ness Monster and all the mystery hominids. So, you know, 10 species of potential hominids. My impression is that it is linked. And then, of course, that leads to the larger question is, does an interest or a belief in cryptids as potentially real animals link to a larger belief in the stuff around the fringes of cryptozoology, UFOs and the paranormal and such? And we have, and I would say on that, there's a spectrum, there's many shades of grey from people who are famously quite negative on those things. So Grover Krantz, for being an example, someone who'd say, no, all that stuff is rubbish and it's irrelevant to what I'm doing, which is just pure zoology, biology. But then on the other hand, you've got people who are completely open-minded to all that stuff. And in some cases, not only embraced it, but built it. So Ivan Sanderson mentioned about 1,000 times in this book, one of the builders of all these concepts about mystery animals is the same guy who's coming up with ideas about, you know, the Bermuda Triangle and underwater mystery objects and flying saucers and ideas about shifting dimensions and all this kind of stuff. We're talking about the same people. So
I think as skeptics we just tend to encounter people with blind spots a lot, that they'll believe in UFOs wholeheartedly and then just think ghosts are ridiculous and Bigfoot's ridiculous, and that people just pick and choose what they believe in.
Yeah. I think you've got everything across the board. You do have people who are open-minded, that's the wrong term to use, but who are prepared to endorse everything. At the other extreme, people who have a fairly rational worldview but just have these, as you say, these blind spots where it's like, I know that humans incorporate alien DNA, or I know that Bigfoot actually does exist and awaits discovery, or that Loch Ness Monster is real. And indeed, you know, it's interesting within the community of people that you would regard as skeptics. There are still people who are, you know, card-carrying, qualified scientists, fully rational people with a realistic worldview, are quite responsible and reasonable on many things, but they may still have this small area of this specific thing that they might endorse or believe in.
Yeah, I think it's a human trait to have biases. Just in the book, you talk about cryptids and how they're often lumped in with UFOs and ghosts and other paranormal subjects. So do you see a difference between cryptozoology and ufology? And if they are all lumped together, why do you think that that's so?
Yeah, this is difficult to really get to the bottom of. I mean, I'm a bit worried I might repeat myself in view of what I've just said, I suppose. But you certainly have some people who would reject all of that other stuff. UFOs and the paranormal and think, you know, there are a list of qualified biologists, paleontologists, zoologists who've written about cryptozoology and have made the point of saying that this is part of zoology. We are endorsing the existence of these alleged creatures as real flesh and blood animals with an evolutionary history. And then at the other end you have people who are linking these alleged zoological phenomena with other phenomena, with the paranormal kind of stuff. And it has been shown, there are some studies showing that there is a link between endorsement of something on the fringes, like a belief in ghosts or UFOs, and a belief in things like Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot. There are some studies that do endorse this, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, you've got people who do reject that stuff. I mean, I can think of many people I know who are interested in mystery animals and insist that they are only studying zoological phenomena, and it's got nothing at all to do with that crazy stuff.
It happens. The whole field is kind of covered up with a spectrum, right? And from what I've heard, I've never been able to make it to an official Bigfoot conference, although I would like to at some point. That my understanding is that at those conferences, there's sort of a pecking order where, you know, the people who would consider themselves to be naturalists, you know, would be, you know, maybe consider themselves above the people who believe that Bigfoot's, you know, able to become invisible or is from outer space or is hyperdimensional, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I wonder if it's fair to say I'm quite happy to say that I originally became interested in cryptozoology because I really did think that the evidence for some of these creatures was looking pretty good. I mean, I wasn't a proper adult at the time, so maybe it's forgivable, but I think for a lot of people they do become interested in this because they only see it as, you know, you look at the descriptions of Bigfoot or sea monsters in your favorite cryptozoological books, and they do sound like rational descriptions of real animals. But what you have to appreciate, and I think we're appreciating this more and more, making more of a big deal of this now, is that those are all those accounts have been modified, they've been polished, people have chosen this particular accounts they want to cover. I mean, it's quite well known among, again, those of us of a skeptical inclination, that when people talk about, say, First Nations lore associated with mystery human-like non-humans of North America, that you read about these accounts that seem to portray the same kind of creature, this like shaggy furred human-shaped thing that isn't a human, but the weirder stuff, the creatures that are sort of more half human, or which can phase in and out of reality, or which sometimes wear clothes, or which sometimes speak and sometimes don't speak, and which have special roles in pulling over trees or cannibalizing the dead, you know, that kind of stuff gets downplayed or even excluded.
Well, as I like to say, the Bigfoot enthusiast is very likely to cite Native American tales of hairy men, but as real creatures, but then they exclude talking foxes, which
yeah. And I wonder if it is fair to say that okay, well, I think I've made the point already that there are indeed, you know, qualified skeptical scientists who do have a genuine interest in cryptozoological mysteries and have investigated them. And indeed, the history of cryptozoological, the research in the Yeti and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster shows that there always have been qualified ivory tower scientists. I'm being completely sarcastic in using that term, but, you know, proper scientists, qualified scientists, supposedly with jobs at stake and so on. There have been people like that right from the start who have invested a lot of their own time and sometimes their reputation, money and such in investigating these stories. So it's not true that skeptical scientists haven't been involved. They always have been involved. However, in terms of where we are now, I wonder if it's true to say that the people who do really promote the I'm talking about here about the scientists, not just kind of, you know, authors or whatever, but people who you'd identify someone who's meant to be a proper critical thinker. Those of them that do have outspoken opinions on given mystery creatures, do they have indications from their body of published work or their statements on subjects? Are there indications that they do have these weird blind spots? And I'm thinking specifically of an author called Henry Bower, who's a qualified scientist who has written a book on Loch Ness. And I've always been surprised at the fact that he seems to be, you know, a proper qualified scientist and knows what he's talking about, and seems to be quite outspoken on the reality of the Loch Ness Monster, and is very critical in his book of critics of the Loch Ness Monster evidence. Well, I've been interested to discover recently that he's a strong critic of AIDS, HIV. He doesn't think that AIDS is linked to HIV. Now, we're not going to start discussing that, but how do I put it politely? I mean, basically, alarm bells are ringing. It's kind of like this indicates that the way this individual is approaching scientific subjects is different from that of the vast majority of us. I think that's fair to say.
We've done a lot of there's been a lot of skeptical research and scientific research and psychological research into the fact that being well educated and being intelligent is not proof against fringe thinking. In fact, it seems like some really intelligent people go down that rabbit hole really far. So,
yeah, I think it's the human condition again.
Yeah. So, I guess the good news is that peer review and that sort of thing can help sort of weed that out. Although it's a process, and that's another show that we'll be doing this season, if we have seasons. I guess we're starting the over 100 season. Whatever. There's a lot of topics I want to go back and look at. One of them has to do with the scientific process and sort of skepticism 101. Because science is self-correcting, but it has to be corrected, right? So.
Yeah, I make the point in the book that in agreement with what I've just said, there always have been skeptical scientists, trained critical thinkers who have endorsed the existence of monsters or have been very interested in it or involved in it. But what's really notable is the number of them has substantially decreased over time. So today, you know, there are still, like I say, qualified people in universities and museums and so on who are prepared to consider or discuss Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, sea monsters, and others, and other monsters and other cryptids. But the number of them has definitely decreased because, sad to say, the evidence just hasn't come in, and more people have begun to appreciate and have discussed the fact that cryptozoology is culture. We're talking about ingrained kind of archetypes that most of us kind of carry with us in our minds, and I think that explains why we say we see some of the things we do.
Well, the good news is properly skeptical people are always prepared to change their opinion in face of convincing evidence. So we're always just one Bigfoot corpse away from, you know, endorsing Bigfoot, right? So,
absolutely, yeah.
A proper Bigfoot corpse, not just a frozen suit filled with possum guts. So,
not naming names.
Yeah, bring it on. I've been interested in every single one of these claims of Bigfoot DNA or whatever. I was a reviewer for the Melba Ketchum study, and I'm not a geneticist, so it was like, tell me, you know, talking to the geneticists, what do these DNA profiles actually mean? Are they right? Is there the core of is there a nugget of truth in here? Is there really some unknown hybrid hominin? And no, it really isn't. Okay, I was surprised how far Ketchum and her colleagues took the fight, but that's been done to death online, hasn't it?
A bit.
Yeah. And it's good that you kept an open mind throughout it.
This is a pet peeve of mine. There seems to be a problem of classifying monsters, because
you get all kinds of sea creatures becoming sea serpents, and then all kinds of hairy hominids become Bigfoot. Despite what, if you listen to the really detailed descriptions, there's big differences in their morphology, the way they're being described. So as an actual trained anatomist to a degree, like or a degreed anatomist, however you want to look at it, how do you approach discrepancies like this?
I've never known how to approach the discrepancies apart from put it all down to the fact that people are not describing the same organisms. I think that's clear. That's clear. So in discussions of lake monster and sea monster identifications, think of one specific case where people can only reasonably describing a single undiscovered species. And I'm thinking of Lake Champlain, Loch Ness. You know, there's Loch Ness, Lake Champlain, whatever, they're not going to be home to 10 different species of large undiscovered animals, okay? If they're going to be home to an undiscovered species, it's going to be one. I think that's a fairly reasonable thing to say, even among... Well, I was going to say even among the most open-minded of believers, but that's not true because I've learned that some of them are prepared to endorse the possibility of multiple species living at Loch Ness. But yeah, the sheer diversity of accounts. I mean, all the famous lakes that supposedly are home to lake monsters. You have your upturned boat monster. You have your long neck monster. You have your giant fish monster. You have things with two humps, three humps, five humps, and variants of humps. But then even more subtle things, like when people encounter the creatures close up, that there are Lake Champlain, there's a couple of cases where people said they've actually had physical contact with Champ. Some cases they say, oh, it was a squidgy, slimy animal with a smooth skin. And you think, well, that sounds reasonable. That's consistent with it being a giant fish or an amphibian or even a big whale thing. But then you have other people saying, oh, I saw it close up and its skin was rough and covered in big scales and gnarly. And it's like, well, you can't have both. And then you have some people saying, oh, I saw it had a fluked tail with distinct, you know, whale-like tail flukes. And, well, again, that sounds reasonable. But then someone else will describe something completely different. Oh, it had a serrated dragon-like tail. And there are so many of these discrepancies. Heads, you know, people talk about ears and horns on the heads of these things and whiskers. And other people saying there is none of that stuff. Other people from in the same places. So they see a small circular head with tiny eyes. You cannot reconcile these discrepancies. You cannot account for, they cannot be descriptions of the same one species. So that's always been a problem, and the only explanation can be that people are seeing or encountering multiple different phenomena, multiple different things, and describing them in different ways, and it's, you know, obviously not necessarily doing a good job of describing them. That's a big part of the issue here, how reliable people are as witnesses and data recallers. That's something I discuss a bit in the book. But I think the take-home message is people are not seeing the same thing, and it's consistent with the fact that there are not single undiscovered species at the bottoms of these accounts. And you could say the same. You could say the same for your classic, your Bigfoot accounts and sea monster accounts. They're so diverse. So the only way people can account for this, people as in, again, sort of pro-believer cryptozoologists, is they come up with these multi-species models. So let's now think about Bigfoot-type creatures in North America. This enormous diversity, this range of coat colors and heights and foot morphologies and things that aren't discussed that much in the books, like whether it had a tail or not, or the size of its teeth, or whether it had pointy ears or human-like ears. The only way you can account for those is if you're going to have multiple undiscovered species. And by that point, if you're seriously proposing that, Grover Krantz said that he knew that proposing that would really turn the whole field into a laughingstock. That really is not a viable option. Maybe we can just about accept the possibility of there being one undiscovered large primate in the remote parts of North America. But the idea that there might be 3, 4, 5, 6 belonging to multiple different lineages with distinct biogeographical histories and occurring across the whole of North America, from Florida to New York to British Columbia and everywhere else, No. it's good to be open-minded, but not so open-minded that your brains fall out, as the saying goes. So I do not think there's a single tidy zoological anatomical solution to these phenomena.
That was a great answer.
It's a very long-winded answer. Sorry.
No.
Nightmare to do a typology of that.
yeah. Oh, that'd be good. Well, if you've read the book, I try and make this point that this isn't okay. So we can say they're probably really. It's unfortunate. There really isn't a large undiscovered hominid in North America. There really isn't a Loch Ness monster. There really aren't sea monsters for us to discover. But this isn't a bad thing. This is still teaching us something that's quite incredible about us, about the way we work, about the way we perceive and imagine the natural world, and then about the way we relate to it, just the way we describe it to others, how we describe our perceptions. And I think that you think how ubiquitous and ingrained all these ideas are now. I mean, how many times have people demonstrated that there isn't a Loch Ness monster? It's been, and the same for some of the other superstar cryptids. It's now been so, it's almost tedious how many times people have come up with good evidence demonstrating that there's a lack of good evidence. Mm-hmm. But so why then does this belief persist? It's like these things, these concepts are hardwired. They are stuck there in our consciousness. And when we go to a lake, say a spooky, dark, deep lake, which could potentially be dangerous to us, particularly when we're young, particularly to kids, I think, and you can say the same for dark forests, I think this is a seriously important sociological/psychological event here. The fact that we are programmed to imagine or perceive creatures of a semi-consistent form, large, smooth-backed creatures in dark water that could be dangerous, humanoid creatures in dark forests and mountains, and I'm not really aware of. Well, there's a few studies that have been done on how this is actually working, how people are perceiving the creatures they are describing. I mentioned Charles Paxton. Charles Paxton is doing work of this kind. He has a new study coming out in a couple of weeks on this, actually. But, I think this is an interesting thing here, and I kind of think it should be studied.
So you think they're kind of based in social conditioning, in a sense, and sort of cautionary tales?
I think there's a list of possible explanations for this. If it is a thing, and I kind of suspect it is, and in terms of seeing humanoid creatures, I mean, I think we've probably already got an explanation for that in that we know that we humans are probably as is the case for all animals, we're programmed to look for other humans, right? We see shapes. We see his faces where there are no faces. And we also see the human profile. It's quite common for children to describe seeing figures standing in their bedroom at night, that kind of thing. I think that's a pre-programmed part of being a social animal, looking for other humans. But then there's this really fascinating idea, which has been discussed a few times, and I should look into this. I don't know what research has been done on this, but are some of the creatures that people say they see, is our expectation that they should be there, is that a kind of deeply ingrained kind of evolutionarily advantageous thing that has been with us throughout history? So as animals that have always had to go to water to collect water to drink, we have always had to contend with animals like, you know, crocodiles and potentially big predatory snakes and giant fish and so on. Does this serve as a hypothesis to explain why we have a fear of big lurking water monsters? Mm-hmm. And I have read arguments where people have proposed that the classic mystery creatures that Funnily enough, this is in a book by Janet and Colin Board called Alien Animals, which is very much of the kind of paranormal side of things. But they propose that the main types of creatures that people claim to see around the world, giant bird-like creatures, giant human-like Bigfoot-type creatures, big predatory cats, water monsters, they say that these are all the sorts of things that would have been dangerous to our ancestors. Not, I don't mean ancestral Homo sapiens. I mean, you know, going way back throughout the whole of history, primates throughout history have been preyed on by big reptiles and big birds and big predatory cats. And it's a real stretch to suggest that we could have some kind of evolutionary, some deep time knowledge that's been passed down over millions of years. I think that is extremely, I don't think it's that likely. When I've spoken to psychologists, evolutionary psychologists, they say nah, we don't think memories sort of hang around, that they're not transferred that way, not from culture to culture, let alone from species to species. So it could be nonsense. But on the other hand, it's kind of tempting to think there's something in it. Why do we report the certain kinds of monsters that yeah. we do? Or am I underselling our artistic ability to just imagine that, well, we know about reptiles like lizards and crocodiles, so wouldn't people always have imagined that there were like 50-foot versions of those things? And mm-hmm.
There may be neurological explanations that don't require that information to be transferred genetically. So the idea, what I'm thinking about in particular is in your brain, I read a lot about this, but I think it was in a book by Ramachandran, he was talking about people who have damage to their brain, and they were asked to draw flowers. And so despite having years and years of experience with particular kinds of flowers, they were only able to draw like a generic kind of flower after the brain damage. It's like they knew what they were drawing, but they couldn't. It was like they were drawing a more of a class of flowers rather than
the flower archetype.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's possible that like there's sort of neurological, I'm going to say the word structure. I don't mean that like there's an organ in your brain, but I mean that there was sort of a saved concept that represented the class of flower, and that if they were going to recognize something to be a flower, it would refer to that first before determining the specific type, right? Yeah. And if that's the case, then the making some of those mistakes may be tied to that sort of class misappropriate use. So I like the one you're talking about for like shapes of a humanoid at the foot of the bed, that kind of thing. That seems to be like a class identification problem to me, like turning shadows into a humanoid shape. But we'll actually be talking about that in our Shadow People episode, which will be coming up this season. So I don't want to spoil everything with my rambling anyway.
Well, I guess we've got a final couple of questions, if we can take a few more minutes of your time.
Yeah, sure.
So you say in the book that we shouldn't doubt that there are still new species which are awaiting discovery. So in your opinion, what kinds of creatures are we likely to find, and will any of these match the creatures which are discussed in the cryptozoological literature?
Yeah, excellent question. The get-out clause on which undiscovered things are there to find is that there are almost definitely new large marine animals to find. I don't think anybody really doubts this. So we can expect a small number of large Chondrichthyan fishes, relatives of sharks and rays, and bony fishes. These animals, they're not going to be radically different things. They're going to be fairly similar to members. They're going to be members of groups we already know about. They're going to be new kind of deep sea dogfishes and members of the oarfish family and deep sea rays, that kind of thing. And even one or two species of cetaceans. I can tell you that there is one new species of beaked whale, which is currently in description. So we know of at least another whale to add to the list. In terms of terrestrial animals, I think it's looking plausible that there are going to be one or two more kind of, you know, hoofed mammals from tropical Southeastern Asia. Large rodents, new monkeys. I don't think that it's completely implausible that the Orang Pendek is for real, that people might actually still have a new ape from Sumatra to discover. I don't think that's That's certainly far more plausible than virtually all the other mystery hominids from around the world.
I'm sorry, but, did you just endorse the ROUS? I'm sorry.
The what?
The rodents of unusual size.
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Sounds like another show too.
Yeah. Well, in Vietnam, in recent years, people have discovered Lao Nasties, the Khao Nha Zoo. It's about something like total length 70 centimeters, a pretty big rodent of unusual size. So there's a couple of things that are going to be discovered like that. But yeah. These animals are very interesting to those of us interested in rodents and unusual sharks and weird, obscure whales. And with the exception of Orang Pendek, which I'm not necessarily endorsing, I'm just saying I'm still on the fence on that one. None of these are classic cryptids. And it's looking like there is not the evidence that we really are going to discover lake monsters and Hooverman's is sea serpents and the classic crypto hominids of the cryptozoological literature. So, new animals to find. I think there's a few to come. In fact, I'll tell you, this is a Monster Talk exclusive. As I sit here now, I have the skull of what's almost certainly a new species of South American deer sat on the desk here, which is a living species, a member of the Mazama genus, a kind of deer called a brocket. So I think there's animals like that that are, due to be published.
But not the superstar cryptids, as you call them.
Alas, alas not.
It's a great phrase.
I hope you think it's appropriate. I mean, I figure there's lots of cryptids, but you can't call all of them superstars. This I mean, the Mongolian death worm.
I'm just waiting to see if scripted sticks. I like that.
Scripted.
We're going to have to make it stick. We're going to have to use it. Get it out there.
Yeah. All right. Well, so this is a repeat for you. As you know, we like to end our interview with what's your favorite monster. So you don't have to stick to what you said before, but currently, what's your favorite monster?
What did I say before?
I don't know. I don't listen to
you
the show.
You tell us.
And it's allowed to be from the world of fiction and reality and everything, yeah?
Anything.
Yeah, well, it's Godzilla, yeah.
Oh, that's probably what you said before.
Oh, sorry. Well, okay, King Ghidorah then. No,
that's good. So I'm excited to hear that I heard Toho's making a new version in their line, a sequel to, Final Wars. So
yeah, it's true. It's true, yeah. The rumors are true. There's some pictures online already, I think.
What's killing me is there's two teaser trailers, one for Ultraman, and one for a Gamera sequel. Apparently neither one of them is funded, as far as I can tell. But both of them look like they could be fantastic. So, have you seen the Ultraman one?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, the Gamera one doesn't look quite as polished. But both of them are basically lobbying to make it a real product. So I hope they succeed. My son will be so happy.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
Anyway. Thanks again for coming to Monster Talk. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Darren. Well, nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, you too. I enjoyed it.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Karen Stolzno, you heard us interview Dr. Darren Naish about his latest book, a volume focusing on cryptozoology called Hunting Monsters. You can find a link to the book and to Darren's blog and his own podcast in our show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk has been on break for me to work on my own book research, and while it will probably be autumn of 2016 before I even finish my first draft, I've really enjoyed all this research time. The book I'm working on is about technology, so I've been immersed in the history of many inventions and the creative process. I think it's going to be a fun and informative work when I finish it. We've already got some great interviews recorded for this new year of Monster Talk, including a long-awaited episode on giant snakes. Topics including shadow people, black-eyed kids, X-Files, aliens, UFOs, and a little bit of skepticism 101 are all in the works for this year. I hope you'll stick around for these and many more topics. We're also going to be a featured podcast for the new Google Play podcast feed. I'm not sure what the release date is for that feature, but we're excited to be a part of it. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends. And if you hated this episode, please share it with your enemies. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Monster Talk's theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.